Earnest is 2021, the year of execution. In order to execute, we have to have information. And the number one place to get the information, EYL University. Shadi, tell them what we bring in.
Yes, EYL University has been reloaded. We already have 100 past webinars. We already have weekly webinars. We already have our private investment group on Facebook. We already have monthly financial planning calls. We already have bi-weekly real estate calls. But what has been added to EYL University this year is access to MG the Mortgage Guy's Home Buyer's Blueprint, which walks you through the home buying process from A to Z. And what also has been added, breaking news alert. Yeah, everybody always asks to be in our group
chat.
How do
I get in there? How
and
I get in
when this? We talk about all the investment plays that we are making, we are going to have investment calls, group chat calls with me, Troy, and the whole team, and walk you through our plays that we're making and give you insight into our portfolios. All of that for 75% off. That's right. We are doing a blowout sale, 75% off for a limited time only. Go to EYLUniversity.com right now and sign up.
See you on the other side.
My graduates from my school being Forbes, bag drop. a mic drop, bag drop.
So you started a business, the E-Rail Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
So basically, something else I like to teach entrepreneurs, especially the ones that's coming out of the corporate world, everybody feels like I got to create something new. Like I got to get into an industry that I see everybody else doing, right? But what I realized is like, man, if this company is paying me $100,000 a year to do this job, there has to be a smaller business out there somewhere that needs these same services, need the same skill set, and I can just go out and provide the service for them. And instead of being their employee, I become their consultant. Hmm. So that's what E-Rail Commerce is. I took all that experience I had, all those connections I had with the railroad, all these oil and gas companies, and I found all these smaller companies that need or want to get a contract with an Exxon, because Exxon has over 10,000 rail cars. Every one of those cars has to be maintained, has to be repainted, has to be cleaned, has to be maintenance done to them. They have to store them when they're not using them. They gotta park them somewhere. So what I do is I help all those companies that provide those services get in the door with Exxon, get the contract, and then they perform all the work, and I just get commissions off of the deals.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So you're like the relationship, man.
I'm basically brokering. Mm-hmm. Basically brokering, and I have everything set up with my clients to where whatever contract I help them get, I get paid.
But so E-Rail is not the only form of consultation that you're providing, right? Don't you have a few other consultation things that you do?
Well, I mean, in general, I just try to help entrepreneurs get started, you know what I mean? Because, I mean, I was so lost when I was trying to get out of the work world, and I was like, man, nobody was really here to guide me and teach me. So I use my social media platform, and, you know, I use that network and that audience as my way to give back, you know? So anybody that has help, wants help with it, getting started in entrepreneurship, I try to teach them the basics, the kind of stuff we're talking about now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I get them as far as I can, and then I try to network with someone that's actually in their field and try to get them to get under that person.
You're providing the mentorship by consulting.
Right.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Consulting is something that we also haven't spoke about yet in this podcast, but it's extremely important, and it's a very profitable business as well.
It is. Yeah.
Consultants, you have consultants in school industry, you have consultants in political industry, you have consultants in all kinds of stuff, right? Can you explain the importance, a lot of times, especially for small business owners, this is the problem with small business owners as compared to big business. Mm-hmm. They have a small way of thinking. They don't understand the power of consulting. They don't understand the power of marketing. They don't understand. They just want to just do the work. It's like running on a treadmill. You can only get so far, right? When you get enough wind behind you, now you can start to fly. So when you talk about the power of consulting, like what can somebody get value out of as hiring the right consultant?
So there's only two ways you're going to learn. You're either going to bump your head and you're going to lose time and money, or you're gonna pay for the knowledge, period. There's no other way you're gonna learn, right? So you hire a consultant. The consultant is someone that's an expert in that field, that's already got experience doing what you're trying to do, or they can help you with a particular area of the business that you can't fulfill. Like if you have a great product, but you don't know how to get it in front of enough people, you need a marketing consultant to come in and help you get it in front of the right people. And so it's basically a way for you to, you can add a whole department to your business without actually having to hire an employee. It's a consultant, you know. That consultant can either be somebody that's paid by the hour, or it could be somebody that I always recommend you get performance-based consultants, which means they work off a commission. So if they don't produce for you, they're not gonna make any money. Right, so that gives them a vested reason to get in there and work hard and get something done. And on the flip side of that, that, like you said, that's a very lucrative business too, because it's a business where it doesn't require you have to invest a lot. You can work from home and be a consultant, and people are actually paying you just for the knowledge that you already have. You know, so you can take that corporate experience. You could, man, you could have been flipping burgers at McDonald's for 5 years, but guess what skill set you got? You know what it takes to onboard a new employee, so you can go to other small restaurants and say, here's the McDonald's model. I'm gonna teach you how to run a McDonald's model for your restaurant.
And that's something that anybody can do. Like, as right. you're saying it, I'm thinking of, like, especially in the education field and especially mm-hmm. in the restaurant field as well. Mm-hmm. It's like people always try to figure out how can they make passive income, mm-hmm. right? And they don't realize that they have a skill set already. Mm-hmm. They're just overlooking it, right? They're not maximizing their potential.
Well, this is one of the things, mm-hmm. when you talk about multiple streams of income, mm-hmm. that is, the average millionaire has seven streams of income. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean he has seven jobs or even seven businesses. It's that they're maximizing their skills, maybe one or two businesses. Mm-hmm. So as you said, you can be a teacher, mm-hmm. right? But you're an expert in that field. Mm-hmm. If you're a really good teacher, now you can be a consultant to school districts, write curriculum, things of that nature, right? And that's something that anybody can do, as Troy said. Even if you're still an employee, you can be an entrepreneur and create your own consulting business.
And the amount of time, it doesn't require as much, right? You can say, these are my hours. You dictate the hours and you dictate the fees.
Yeah, and, right? and a lot of times you're helping different customers and clients with the same problem.
Exactly.
So you already know it, like in and out, you know?
For your consulting business, how did you market yourself to your customers or clients?
Man, the most powerful tool I use is LinkedIn.
Okay.
And what I liked about LinkedIn is because when you put yourself on there as a business owner, you give yourself whatever title you want, you know? So I gave my, it's me and one partner, but my title is Executive VP. Mm-hmm. So that puts you in a whole different arena when you get on
there. Look at you like, oh, right? Executive VP.
It's all perception.
That's a fact. That's a fact.
So then when I see a company that I'm trying to get a connection with, and I go to the CEO and request to connect with them, they be like, oh, it's another executive that wants to connect with
me. Yeah, we got an exec that wants to meet you.
Yeah, and that's all it is, it's positioning. And it's all about, you know, what you post. I repost a lot of Wall Street Journal type articles that are related to the industry. Any type of insight that I get from anybody else that's in the industry, I'll make a post about that. So then you kind of position yourself as a subject matter expert. So then what happens is eventually enough people are watching your posts to where when they have a problem, they come to you instead of you having to go out and ask for business. Mm. And another great thing I like about LinkedIn is because you can type in any job title you want. So I'm in supply chain, right? Mm-hmm. I type in director of supply chain, LinkedIn is gonna give me a list of people with that title. So all I do is go connect, you know? And then that builds your audience because people go to check you out to see who is this that's asking to link with me. And then my network on LinkedIn is like 17,000. It's all industrial products, supply chain people from all these big companies.
Yeah,
that's a lot. Well, man. LinkedIn, you got to accept every single person, right?
Yeah, the person has to approve the connection. But if your page is set up to where it looks like, oh, this is somebody that I might want in my network, then you're good. And that's the whole purpose of, you know, making sure that you set yourself up right on there with the right titles, right?
You send in mail, right? Mm-hmm. They send you in mails or you
both? I guess I'm both. Yeah, I met with a guy, matter of fact, he flew in from Arkansas last week because he's working with a private development group that does industrial development, and they're looking for new locations to build new rail terminals. And that was part of my job when I worked in the railroad, so that's part of my consulting too. So he literally reached out to me because he had been seeing me make these posts on LinkedIn about railroad development and railroad terminals. So this guy literally flew in for the day just for that meeting.
Wow. So you are using your resources efficiently, and a lot of times people don't realize that, like, mm-hmm. they're just on LinkedIn or they're just on Facebook, mm-hmm. just to put pictures up, not networking and not realizing how powerful a tool mm-hmm. they have at their fingertips.
Well, LinkedIn is only for networking, mm-hmm. but I gotta get a better. I actually got to do a better job on LinkedIn because I don't know. I just don't feel too comfortable with it. I mm-hmm. feel like it's kind of boring.
I think I have a page too.
It is boring, but it's like Facebook, but it's for business only. You know what I mean?
It's powerful.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, you would be surprised the people that don't have a lot of LinkedIn followers that are like powerful people. Like, I mean, like producers, executive producers at these big stations, they may have 500, 1,000 connections, and you go request it and it's approved the next day, you know? But it's like a back door to get the connection that usually you have to call a corporate headquarters and talk to an administrative person and ask a scheduled time to meet this person. You just go to LinkedIn and find them.
So when you need, it's like getting you past all those steps,
exactly.
Right? Like
the all the gatekeepers. Yeah, the gatekeepers. You bypass all the gatekeepers.
If the person's on LinkedIn.
If they're on there.
But yeah. Everybody's on LinkedIn. And LinkedIn is the one is the most powerful search thing too, because like so when you search somebody's name on Google, the first thing that comes up is LinkedIn.
Yeah, yeah.
That's like the first thing. It's like it's like your online resume, pretty much.
It is.
And so I don't know how they work that with the algorithm, but they always are on the top of your thing. So you kind of have to have a LinkedIn page if you're doing anything in business. It's like almost mandatory.
Yeah, I agree.
I gotta update mine.
So. Yeah, man. Definitely.
All right. So that was good info. So now, in the last time we want to go into real estate, we're gonna talk all thing real estate.
Yeah, you got some big things going on.
That's what you're focused on now. Yeah. So yeah, for sure. All right. So in the last segment, we're gonna talk about real estate, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay, what made you go into real estate first and foremost?
Like I said, I kind of fell into it with the corporate job and leaving, and I had bought a house at the first gig, and when I moved back to Houston, I couldn't sell it, so I had to get a property manager. Property manager rented it out. I was making like $400 a month, and I wasn't working at all for it. I was like, this seems like something lucrative. And you know, the more you research real estate, it's like 80% of first time millionaires are made in real estate.
But this is at a relatively young age, right? Like your first property was at 22?
Yeah, 22.
That's pretty young, man.
Yeah, 22. Man, so that was kind of a blessing through having worked with the railroad while I was in school.
Okay.
I had enough tenure with them to actually qualify for a moving package. Ooh. So when you work with a corporate company, when they move you, they either give you a stipend or they give you like a down payment towards a house.
Oh.
Yeah, and so they gave me the down payment, and instead of me getting an apartment and pocketing the money, I decided to get a house.
So, but you could have took the stipend.
I could have took the stipend.
You thought the long-term plan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you're not an engineer by mistake.
Nah, man, I know, yeah, yeah.
So, all right, but so then how did that transition to you doing what you're now as far as you're developing?
So, okay, so when I moved to Houston, I decided I wanted to go really hard in the real estate game. And so one of my line brothers, my frat brother, worked for Homevestors, the We Buy Ugly Houses people, and he was their property manager in the hood. And so I kind of told him what I wanted to do. And so he ended up plugging me with one of the contractors that Homevestors use. And this guy was flipping 20, 30 houses a month for them, doing actual rehab work. And so he kind of became my mentor, and we would pick houses. I would flip them. Of course, he would make money off of the rehabs. And so that's how I kind of got into the real estate game in 2009. I would sell some of them. I kept some of them for rentals. And I was doing that for about 5 years. But then I got tired of having rental property. I mean, I know everybody says that that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to buy a home to live in and have rental property. But man, owning rentals sucks.
Yeah. Wow, what are some of the downfalls?
Okay, so a lot of people, so a good profit margin on a rental property is $300 or $400 a month.
Okay.
Right? But you have 1 month, say like a tenant moves out, and then it takes you a month to find another tenant. And if your mortgage payment is $1,200, that's literally 3 months of your profit gone. If you gotta make a repair, that repair is $1,000, that's another 2.5 months of profit gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so for me, it was like, and then you have this debt. I was owing like 100, 120 on each house. And so now you got debt and you got these small profit margins. And it's like, okay, I can see how long-term I can continue to do this and make money slowly. But dealing with tenants tearing stuff up, you know, it just wasn't something that I enjoyed doing.
What type of properties were you looking for? Was it single family homes or multifamily or property?
Yeah, at that point in time, I didn't qualify for anything like extravagant. So okay. I was just buying little single family homes. And I'm saying there's nothing wrong with it. It's, you know, everybody can make money in any industry. But for me, it's just like I want to do something bigger. And so as I continued to flip, I started realizing, you know, this narrative about gentrification happens over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, man, I know a few of us that are flipping. I don't know anybody that's really trying to get into the development game and you know, kind of change the narrative so we have some control over that. So 2013, that's when I decided to kind of get off into that.
So were you buying land in 2013? Was that the next step?
I didn't know what I was going to buy. I just knew what I was going to do is stop flipping and try to figure it out.
Okay.
So I just started talking about it. And man, it came full circle. My same line brother that helped me get into the game, he had an old tenant reach out to him that used to be in one of the properties and say, hey, I'm over here in Fifth Ward and the landlord over here isn't taking care of the property. I think he's on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what he heard was opportunity. So he reached out to me and he's like, man, I think we got an opportunity to go pick up a few houses over here. So I went to go meet with the guy, ended up being a whole block. Mm-hmm. Had a grocery store on it.
How much was that?
Okay. true story, at the time, this was in the hood. It wasn't worth nothing. It was probably worth $300,000, the whole block.
The whole block.
The entire block.
Everything was kind of run down. But it's in the area where you tell somebody I'm about to go spend $300,000, they're like, man, are you crazy?
Right.
It's the hood.
You know? It's the hood. Yeah. Yeah, nothing but drugs and prostitution over there. You're going to waste your money, you know? So what I ended up doing, to talk him into doing the deal, I offered him $400,000 for it. So, but of course, I didn't have the cash to pay $400,000. So he actually had inherited the property from his dad. His dad was like a real estate tycoon. Had like 26 blocks over there. Mm.
26 blocks?
26 blocks.
Whoa.
26 blocks. And this block happened to be the one that they gave this kid. And he was like the horrible kid. You know what I mean?
He botched it.
Yeah, yeah. So this was the one he had, and he still wasn't taking care of it. So I offered him an owner finance scenario where I was like, I'll give you 10% now.
What's owner finance?
So that's when instead of going to the bank, the owner that actually doesn't have any debt on the property will let you make payments over time to buy the property from him.
Mm.
So I gave him 10% of what we agreed to, the $400,000, so $40,000, which came from me selling one of my rental properties. And then that allowed me now to control that whole block of property. And it had the grocery store on it, and it had the houses, but everything was really run down. So instead of fixing it up, what I decided to do was do parolee housing for felons, mm. because it's really hard for them to find anywhere to live.
Mm-hmm.
So I would rent them out a single room in each one of the houses, charge them $350 a month. It was something that they could afford because of the type of jobs they could get. You know, they didn't have much income.
Or was that like a halfway house?
Pretty much like a halfway house. Okay. Yeah, they call them SRO houses.
And then, yeah. So the state pays you that, right?
Sometimes, if it depends on what program they're in, they get some type of housing assistance. But most of the time, no, they had to go get a job.
Okay.
So that's what made it really good, because you talk about a low risk tenant. You got somebody that's happy to be out of prison. They was in prison for a non-violent offense. I didn't do violent people. They had to keep a job, and they had to keep somewhere to stay. And 99% of the places wouldn't even allow them to live there. So they were like built in good, high revenue for me. You know what I mean? As collectively in each house, whereas I could have rented that whole house for $500 to a regular family. Now I'm making $1,100-$1,200 off that same house, you know, with this program.
Because you were renting the rooms?
Renting them individual rooms. Okay. And most of them had trades. So they were like carpenters, electricians, plumbers. They all learned their trades in prison.
Yeah.
So anything went wrong, I just drop off materials. They would fix it.
Oh, wow. You know what I mean? The wind is built in.
and they were just happy to have somewhere to live, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so that worked out. That was a win-win, man. And then that was 2013, 14, 15, I did that. In 2016, redevelopment kind of started in the area that I was in. Something else that I always watched too, even when I was flipping, is what the city's plans were. And you can go to the planning department's website, and it'll tell you what they're planning to do 5 years, 10 years down the road. And that's a lot of the game that we don't pay attention to.
Mm.
But you know, the other groups pay attention to
that. Where can you find that information at?
Usually you can just Google it, like planning and development department or urban planning for whatever city you're in, and it'll pull up on their website. You know, it's usually a .gov type website, and it'll have all their information. A lot of it's talked about at city council meetings, so you can look up city council meeting minutes,
mm-hmm.
and it'll tell you about anything big, any developer that's proposing to do something in a certain area. All that has to be publicly announced. So, but what I noticed about Houston was that everything was going counterclockwise around downtown. And the Fifth Ward neighborhood that I was buying in was the last quadrant. So I knew eventually it was gonna come. I just didn't know when, you know? And so, yeah, so that's how I got into it. And 2016, another guy started building. So then I figured it was time for me to try to figure out how to get it done.
So what is your, all right. So what's your philosophy on gentrification? How do you feel about that?
So gentrification has a very negative connotation in our community, because we are never the ones revitalizing that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is the people that are revitalizing are looking out for themselves or their own groups. It's not that they don't care about us, it's that they have their own personal agendas that they're moving forward. And so we can either continue to watch it happen, or we can participate, right? And we can participate in a way that we kind of control the narrative of what's being built, who it's being built for, and what happens to the surrounding community that we're building in. Right. So my goal with my project was, you know, most of the time when you hear about black builders in black neighborhoods, it's low income stuff. And I feel like that's great. Like, we do need to look out for the low income people.
Mm-hmm.
But we got to attract the people that were successful, the people that made it out those neighborhoods and back to those neighborhoods, because we need that income. We need that demographic if we ever want a grocery store to come back. We can't sit and depend on the government to do that. Mm-hmm. And right now what happens is the people that are successful, they go and buy houses in the suburbs, right? It's not because they don't want to move back, it's because they have no options. Mm-hmm. So my focus was, well, let me start building some market rate stuff, not low income housing stuff, but try to attract these working professionals back to the neighborhoods with a high quality product that they, you know, they're gonna pay the same price they're paying in the suburbs. And in the city, your value is gonna appreciate a whole lot more, especially when that neighborhood starts to revitalize.
And that's kind of what you've done with, you know, the land that you bought in 2013.
Right.
Which is the most recent development that you worked on. It's a mm-hmm. 14, is it 14?
Yeah, 14 units.
14
yeah.
units.
14 individual townhouses. Townhouses, yeah.
Yeah, you wanna talk about that, how that came about?
Yeah, so this is the same property that I bought with the grocery store and everything.
Okay.
So 2016, I decided to just tear everything down. Uh-huh. When I saw there was another developer that was building houses deep in the neighborhood, and he was selling them for $250 before they were complete. He wasn't even listing them on MLS. Mm. So I'm like, so that tells me that there's a mindset. There's enough people out there that are willing to save $100,000 because everything else inside the city loop, like inside 16 loop, was $350 or more. So, but people would rather save that money and live in a neighborhood that was still pretty rough. So I was like, well, if he can do this deep in the neighborhood, I'm right on the feeder to the highway. You know, I got a view of downtown. I should be able to do something with my property too. And so that's when I decided I'm gonna move forward with this initiative, try to build these townhouses. And it took a lot of work. It took me building the right team because I had no idea what I was doing. Goes back to what you're talking about earlier with the consultant. I had to find the right team, I had to find a builder that had enough experience that was willing to kind of lend his knowledge and time to me, of course, for a fee. You know, I had to pay him to be my consultant, basically teach me how to do the first project. But that's what I did.
So what's your plans now as far as how many projects are you working on? Like what's your vision look like for the next 5 years?
Next 5 years, I want to finish this project, which will probably be finished next year. And I want to continue to build the same model in the same neighborhood. I kind of want to make this like a real world example that can be duplicated in other cities. Like we can go in, we can buy the land. And I didn't mention my entire team is from the community too. Mm-hmm. So like my builders, my real estate brokers, my insurance brokers, everybody.
Contractors as well?
Contractors as well, yeah. I'm working with a black builder. So, and it's not just anybody, it's people that got good reputations, but we kind of always silo ourselves and we never really collectively work together on stuff. Yeah. So, and the goal, and the most important part of all of this, whether you're flipping another industry, a lot of people in is wholesaling or building new construction, is ensuring that you put the product in front of the right end buyer. Because if you're flipping, you call yourself buying a block, but if you're not watching who you're selling to on the back end,
right,
you're still gentrifying the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So my goal is really to educate us on, like I said, the working professional on why it's better for you to buy over here. Yeah. So I'm building the first three now. Got contracts on two of them. Both of them are young black professionals, basically oil and gas professionals.
That's townhouses, right?
The townhouses, yeah. I got a dentist, a black dentist from Dallas that's looking at buying one. You know, so it's all about making sure that we create that model. Because right now that gentrification narrative is the only thing that's real. Mm-hmm. And for our people, we do better when we see examples of something that's actually working. And so when this is complete, I want to make sure that this model gets as much exposure as possible. It's not about me making all the money. I want people in other cities to do the same thing. You know, to say it's possible, we really can't do this, and this is the example.
How do you evaluate like what area you want to, I know you say you look at the city plans, mm-hmm. but do you have like a set formula, or is it just kind of like you just know the area and you just kind of have a good feeling? Because you can buy in some bad neighborhoods and they don't get better,
right?
Right? So it's like, how do you know like this is probably going to get better?
It's all about your network, because you got to be talking to people in the industry. So a lot of the realtors that I work with, they work with builders, and you know, you got to have a network of commercial realtors around you too, because they know where the commercial developers are looking at, what areas they're looking at. So it's a lot of it's word of mouth in addition to what you see on the city plans, you know. But yeah, you got to have your foot in the door. You got to be on the inside understanding where they're moving, and you just kind of ride that wave along with them.
Yeah, a few years ago, y'all had one of the most horrific hurricanes in United mm-hmm. States history. Mm-hmm. What impact have you seen since then on the real estate in Houston?
Man, you know, it was a period of time where the houses in the areas that did not get flooded, mm-hmm. the values went up tremendously, or they were getting bought up really, really quickly. Mm-hmm. I didn't see too much of a negative impact. The only thing that I did see is a shift in ownership, where the people that didn't have the proper flood insurance, who lost their homes, had to become renters for a while, right? But at the same time, the investors who had the cash on the table were able to pick up a whole bunch of properties for a lot less than what the values were. Anything under like $200,000 was still selling as it was rehabbed, but anything above that $200,000 mark, a lot of it sat on the market. A lot of it's still here now. We had a lot of out-of-town investors that bought, that thought that they could buy these flood houses and flip them and sell them really quickly. But the people in those price points were not comfortable, you know, setting up their homestead again in an area that just flooded like that. So
what's your outlook for Houston, for anybody that's interested in maybe coming in and investing? Optimistic for the city?
Very optimistic, man. Houston, on the next census, they're going to announce that Houston is now larger than Chicago. So it's going to be
number three.
It's going to be the third largest city.
Yeah,
and Houston was least hit by the recession because we didn't have the big inflation in home prices that other markets had. When you look at like international investment as far as real estate in the United States, Houston is number one, whether it's coming from China, Australia, Nigeria, anywhere, basically. They invest here because if you're looking at the three or four biggest cities, the real estate is still cheaper here.
Yeah.
Like I said, and the economy was not hurt as much as the other big markets by the recession, so it's the safest bet. Not only that, but you got more people moving to Texas every year. And like I said, Houston is rapidly growing, so the real estate outlook is strong for this market. I mean, there's two things that I believe are kind of the wave of the future for investing, is either tech or is real estate, because no matter how, as technology will advance and replace people and jobs, but people always have to have a place to live. I mean, that's never going to change.
Yeah.
And I think it's the biggest city land-wise.
Yeah, it is.
Square footage, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more room for it to be developed.
It is. And what it is like, it's spreading out and it's consuming all the smaller towns around it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're all merging into one big municipality.
You think a part of that population increase is due to the influx of people who were misplaced after Hurricane Katrina, or?
I mean, we saw a wave of that.
Okay.
But, a lot of it, no, it's just business. It's just it's attractive, you know. Mm-hmm. You got a lot of people that move from high real estate markets like California. They sell their house out here, and you know, it could be a regular 1800 square foot house in California. They sell it for $1.2 million, come out here and buy a mansion.
Yeah,
you know, so a lot of people transition down here because just the cost of living is cheaper.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sure. So thank you, man.
Thank you.
Thank you for rocking with us.
My graduates from my school being Forbes. Backdrop.
Backdrop.
A mic drop. Bag drop.
Bag drop.